forever the meeting.
So, welcome, and we're going to get going because we're going to fill the time, I think. Thank you for being here. This session addresses a really probing question, which is, what does money have to do with our bodies and our earth? What does money have to do with voice, violence, and peacemaking? Money. What does it have to do with it? Our thesis is that usurious modern money leverages our bodies and our earth. It silences our voices and it wages war, all to serve private interests. But we can change it. And to put it musically, ooh, what's money got to do with it? What's money but a means of exchange? What's money got to do with it? Our money is debt and we don't even know it. Ooh, what's money got to do with it? What's wrong with our money and the banks? What's money got to do with it? Bank issued money keeps everyone enslaved. Ooh, what's money got to do with it? What's money but a unit of account? What's money got to do with it? Let's transform our money before it's too late.
Very honored and pleased to be here, able to present to you in this wonderful space and beautiful, prestigious conference. We are
Lucille. I come from Central Illinois, and I got into monetary reform sort of through my life story, but it crystallized in writing my dissertation in the 1990s, a study on value in economics, ethics, and education. And of the many insights in there, it was finding my way to interest at the heart and usurious interest at the heart of our money system that is the flaw. And the grounds that fed that were starting in junior high, where I worked in a recycling program in New York, in high school, where I worked on hunger issues with migrant farm workers on Long Island, and in college, hunger issues internationally, globally, started this little soup and bread program, and then went off to West Africa during college years, Botswana and Southern Africa. After that, worked then in urban issues in Chicago, an urban studies program, and finally then went to make reading and writing my work for a while. And that's what I did as a graduate student. And that work led me to monetary critique and reform. And I teach future teachers now and teachers who are preparing to be principals.
Hi, I'm Sue Peters. I live in New York.
Can you hear
me?
Do you have a mic?
Yes, I do.
Sorry.
Just hold it up.
So, I come
you
from...
You have to hold it right up to your
mouth. Really up to I come from New York City. I found this money system, not by working in a bank, though. I was working in a multinational bank on Wall Street for 15 years. And while I was there, one night I was looking at a video. I was lying on my bed. It was like 11 o'clock. I was looking at this video, and it was a documentary. And I said, okay, you know, it'll make me smarter. And then it said, oh, this is the way the money is created. And it goes this way, that way. And I go, what? And literally for 6 months, I tried to understand, because it wasn't the way it was taught to me. I didn't have anything in my head to relate it to. But I was working in a bank.
And I was very smart. I loved what I did. And I got very motivated to teach this to other people. Because it's so critical to all our lives and the lives of our children and the health of the earth we all need. Yeah.
My name's Bo Young Lim. I'm here from beautiful Toronto, Canada. I grew up in an immigrant family, and we struggled to make ends meet. So I was taught to work hard, follow the rules. Anything around activism of any kind, we didn't do that. I didn't do that. And I'm like Sue, who has that banking experience, and Lucille, who comes from an economic experience, I pretty much stayed away from anything to do with finance and money most of my life. Up until about 2 years ago, I stumbled onto monetary reform through my environmental work. And I'm convinced that it is a key piece because money touches just about everything.
I'm Mary Sanderson.
I'm Mary Sanderson.
My father's farm up the road in Columbus here was very nearly foreclosed in 1933 when he was 10. I think that he was traumatized by that, for he spent his life studying history all till the very end, trying to understand how that was even possible to happen. What to a child looked like my dad's eccentricity, I now see more as his search for important keys to general prosperity. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should keep it. Just for a minute. Monetary creation, as it turns out,
is totally
is a hot topic.
Sorry.
It's a hot topic. In June this year in Switzerland, citizens will vote whether to keep the age-old system of letting private banks create the money as debt for their own profit first, or to assign money creation to the Swiss Central Bank, which is obligated to work for the good welfare of the commons. We are here, oh, there's a handout about that, about this. It's called the Fall Geld. It's one of the handouts about this Swiss initiative this year. It's a first. We're here to consider that same question about the creation of money. How should it be created? And in the United States context, and how should the money that we all need to get paid and to buy stuff, how should it be created?
So think of today as a door opening for you. I mean, it's a very complicated and multi-layered topic, so we don't want to overwhelm you, but there's a lot that we want to share. But first, we thought it would be really good for people to just explore even just our experiences with money itself before investigating into the actual system. So you're going to have a chance to share in pairs. So turn to the person sitting next to you. You'll have about a minute or two, and here, choose one of these questions. It's up on the screen. What's your experience of money? So you could talk about what talk or dynamic was there about money in your family as a child growing up, or what did you learn about the money system in school, or in the present time? You know, is money, topics related to money, something that you and your friends and your family commonly talk about, you know, in an honest and transparent way? And there's so many feelings attached. So turn to your partner. You'll just have 1 or 2 minutes, and I'll just remind people to switch after 2 minutes so everyone has a chance. So everyone have a partner?
Yes.
Oh. And begin. So if you could finish your sentences and just switch so the other person has a chance. Thank you. Switch.
Thank you.
How was the time?
With this money that we got. So I don't.
So welcome back.
So, what I have to do is
Welcome back. If you can hear my voice, clap once. If you can hear my voice, clap three times.
Can you tell that I'm a teacher?
We'd love to, hear some of the stories from your lives. Unfortunately, just because of time, I'm just going to do a very quick hands up, okay? How many people knew how much money their parents made when they were growing up as a child? Hands up. And look around.
One.
Look around. Okay.
Two.
How many people regularly talked about money and finances over the dinner table?
I don't know. It's one
banner.
Okay. But everybody, look around. There's a few hands up, but most of the hands, not so much, which is pretty usual. How many people learned about the money system? What money is, how it gets created? Look around, couple hands. Did people's families fight about money?
Oh, yeah, all the hands go up.
Was there, okay.
That's good.
I'm going to stop there. Okay. I'll just say, it's kind of like fish in water. We use it all the time. We're surrounded by it. We are taught in our societies to chase after it and to find more of it. But very, very few of us understand how the system actually works. And very few of us understand that we can actually have a different system that works for people. And so that's the thing that we want to try to do with you today to open up that door.
Okay. So thank you for your participation. We met, the four of us, through the American Monetary Institute, which was founded by Stephen Zarlinga, who grew up in the Chicago area, long history, worked in finance himself some, but was
somebody who the last 20, 25 years of his life devoted himself to studying the lost science of money. And so studying the history, the empirical history of money in an analytical way. And he produced this book and founded this institute, and in 2005, I think it was, started to have annual conferences. I was at that first one. Sue was at one a couple later. Bo Young was at actually Stephen's last one when he was alive. So all of us have a different length of time with the organization, but I kept going back to conferences. I'm not a conference being, really. I'm a professor who's not a conference being. But I went back because I learned. He brought this eclectic group of people together from all different kinds of work. Engineering, you know, making roads, healthcare, finance, teaching, education. Anyhow, and I finally made my way through the book. It's honestly, I don't think it's very well written, but it is incredibly well researched. And I would read my way in this chapter and that, you know, because I started at the beginning. In the beginning, I was like, oh, this is strange. But finally, like three summers ago, I kept doing that. And I was like, I'm going to start from the beginning and go cover to cover. And in 3 weeks, full time, read the whole thing. And the sweep of history and the lost science of money as a unit of account that exists by law, by agreement between and among people to use it as a means of exchange. And one of my most favorite aspects is that he defines usury. You may know the term usury as something that Christianity, Judaism, Islam, many most major religions and philosophies had an edict against it. And it got reinterpreted as, just extreme interest is usury. And Stephen gave this definition of usury: the structural misuse of a society's money system. And it threads through the book in a very interesting way. Our ignorance today, I don't know if you experienced that, or our fear, our anxiety about money that may have come out in your discussions, helps to maintain the system as it is. And our consent to it arises out of our ignorance of it, and it is really our own oppression by the money power that keeps it going. So we are oppressed to varying degrees. Many in this room are more oppressed than others in this room. All of us are less oppressed than many, many other people in the world. And yet, the vast majority of us, 80 to 90%, pay in interest over our lifetimes far more than we ever earn it in it. And it's only when you get to what the Occupy movement called the 1% that you hit people who we're doing it all for through our monetary exchange relations. And so Freire called this internalized oppression or submerged consciousness, our own ignorance and consent to our own oppression. But it was not always so, and it need not be so today. And in my comments are just going to share a little bit of the history that Stephen uncovered in here, but he starts back from 300 BC or AD?
3500 BC
he starts. We're starting in pretty much, you know, the 1800s or so. but prior to that, our own American history, our Revolutionary War, which of course we stole the land from the people who were here, and that's a whole piece of this history. The war was not fought over tea, really. It was fought over money. And the British wanted us to use the British money here. And there wasn't enough of it to facilitate the exchange among people being productive in trying to grow food and build houses, etc. And so we created the Continentals, which was a paper note spent into circulation to facilitate the exchange of the community and receivable back in taxes by the colonies. And that's really what our war was fought over. The second war of this nation is, you know, ostensibly about slavery, and very much it did importantly end the system of slavery here, but that system of slavery depended, and I won't go into those details, but very much on this money system. The whole imperial, the Dutch East Indies Company, that was the first place there was a central bank credit creating money system. And then the Bank of England and the British East Indies Company. But back to American history, the Civil War was also fought with the right kind of money. There wasn't enough money to wage a war, and the greenbacks were spent into circulation to pay soldiers, to buy at least arms that were produced here, and it served as a means of exchange. But the system was kind of co-opted not completely understood by the powers that be, except this man, Alexander Del Mar, incredible monetary historian. Stephen introduced me to his work. He has about 20 books, and he studied around the world, libraries around the world, on money. And now I lost my train of thought. He was the first director of the Bureau of Statistics for the United States in the 1860s. And he was fired from that position, basically, because he believed in money as illegal. It exists legally. It exists by law, not by nature. And he was very much against sort of commodity money, and especially gold, because it wasn't enough. But anyhow. And then Edward Kellogg, he was a businessman in New York. He had a wholesale trade dry goods industry, but he also invested in real estate in Brooklyn. And he was hurt by the 1837 panic, and he started studying money. And he wrote a book. I mean, the interesting subtitle of his book is that's there, A New Monetary System. The subtitle is The Only Means of Securing the Rights of Labor and Property and of Protecting the Public from Financial Revulsions. And his book lays out a very interesting proposal that this contemporary book, The Ecology of Money by Adrian Kuzminski, lays out in his second to last chapter. He calls it The People's Money and resurfaces it. And I'm still wrapping my head around it. And we can talk more later if you're interested. But Frederick Soddy, he was a chemist. He was a Nobel laureate chemist. I don't know, his work was on the origins of the conception of isotopes. In 1922, won the Nobel Prize. But he also studied money. And The Role of Money is one of his books. Another, Wealth, Virtual Wealth and Debt, The Solution to the Economic Paradox. And one of our colleagues is incredibly invested and informed by Soddy's work. It was not only men, though. There were women in the 1800s in the populist movement. Kellogg's book was actually published posthumously by his daughter, who did all the work. But Mary Elizabeth Lease, she was from the East Coast, but married actually a pharmacist. And they tried to homestead in Kansas. They moved to Kansas. She was a wife, mother, a Georgist, which is a whole movement some of you may know about, a suffragist. But she was an orator, much better than me, in speaking to the public. And so the Populist Party, she was sort of in a lecture circuit in working on the populist movement and railed sort of against the moneyed men. Sarah Emery was also a populist orator and a teacher, a wife, a mother, and she published this book. You can find it online, both of their
called Seven Financial Conspiracies Which Have Enslaved American People. And in the back of this book is the Populist Party platform from 1892. That's an important date. In just a moment, I'll get to. But in this is what they said. I don't know if you'll understand it, but it says, "We demand a national currency, safe, sound, and flexible, issued by the general government only. A full legal tender for all debts, public and private, and that without the issue of banking corporations." That's the flaw, and they knew it back then that we are still needing to work on. And I could read more, but I won't. And then I just think, you know, they were of the Populist Party. And I understand maybe people have diverse issues about populism here, but my view is, why do we see the history of populism to Trump's so-called populists? This is our history that we don't know. So the question is, why don't we know it? And I'm going to get to that. But the last woman was Sarah Gertrude Coogan. You can find this book online on the HathiTrust. But she was the first woman to earn a master's from Northwestern University in finance and economics and looked at money. And she wrote this book, Money Creators. Who creates money? Who should create money? Written in 1935, well after our current system was set up in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act. So the question is, what happened such that we've lost this critical literacy and historical knowledge about money? There might be many explanations for that, but this is one. University of Wisconsin Madison professor, if any of you are in education, you may have read Edward Krug's The Shaping of the American High School, a two-volume, you know, in-depth empirical study on how we got the high school, how mass secondary education began in the U.S. And this little tidbit jumped out of me in this book when I was reading it for my dissertation. And that tidbit is that in the late, you may know the common school movement with primary schools that started in the 1800s, but secondary school, it was like in the 1890s. And there were, you know, large urban districts that had schools, and there was something called the Committee of Ten. It was out of the NEA. The NEA started in the 1850s, I think, that still exists today. And the Committee of Ten was a chair and then nine men, university professors, university presidents, and what was called schoolmen, who were the superintendents from large school districts, the first ones to start. And these nine guys were the chair of a subcommittee on different areas of the curriculum. So one of the areas was history, social science, and political economy. And this was way before the internet, probably, you know, before many phones. And so they met together in person, and that subcommittee met in Wisconsin itself. And they were deliberating what should the curriculum be of this second, of the high school, what should it be? And one of the members of that committee was a young historian named Woodrow Wilson. And this little tidbit, you know, this is a detailed history of all this committee work, et cetera, but he talked about these meetings happened at, like, late after Christmas in December of 1892. And Woodrow Wilson proposed two proposals in the committee that are reported here. One was that high school should not, students should not study empirical history, evidentiary history. That does not have a place in secondary school. And these planks had to pass unanimously. Do you think that one passed? How many think it passed? The rest of you are right. It did not pass. They did something right. The second plank was that political economy should not be part of the curriculum.
The study of how we survive, make a living within community, within a ecosystem. Did that pass?
Yes.
No.
Unanimously, they passed that that political economy should not be part of the curriculum. So in the same year that the Populist Party had this platform, many other pieces of it, but that was one plank, the 8-hour workday had just been won in the 1870s in Chicago. There weren't even child labor laws yet. And they said, this content will be excluded. We, maybe four, five, six generations later, five maybe, are the product of the exclusion of those contents from teacher to student to teacher to student to teacher to student. No wonder we don't know blank about our money system. I think that's it. And then 20 years later, the system of money and banking that we have today was institutionalized and normalized in the founding of the Fed in 1913, which went through some changes in the 1930s that included establishing of the FDIC, which had to exist in order to shore up this faulty, flawed, usurious system. And we've been teeter-tottering on that. Okay, so. I am now going to pass the baton, the little clicker, to Mrs. Einstein.
I didn't take that because of my hair, but my fellow friends here pointed it out to me this morning. I'm Sue. Can everybody hear me? Is this clear? Okay, great. So I'm going to explain the core of the system, which is very simple, but it's hard to put it in our lives. So I'm going to go slow, okay? There's going to be two parts to it. One is the core of the system, how it works, and the second part is the consequences to all of our lives. The system. Listen up. This is the core. Private banks. You probably have checking accounts in banks. Those are private commercial banks. Create the money we all use. Okay? 97% of our money, we don't really go and use cash very much anymore. We write checks, we have credit cards, debit cards. That's bank-created money. Private banks, they making the decision. It's not taught in our schools. Okay? So, this is me when I found out about the system. I can't tell you. I was like, what? And private banks create our money, not our government? Wait a minute. I don't believe it. It's too hard to believe. So, you don't have to just believe me and us up here. You don't have to believe me here. Listen to others. This is Mr. Robert Anderson. He was Secretary of the Treasury for President Eisenhower. And he said,
when a bank makes a loan, it simply adds to the borrower's deposit account in the bank by the amount of the loan. The money is not taken from anyone else's deposit. It's new money created by the bank for the use of the borrower.
Thank you. This is Mr. Mariner Eccles. He was chairman of our Federal Reserve System under President Franklin Roosevelt. And he said,
this is what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money.
And this is Mr. Michael Meacher. In 2014, he was a member of Parliament. Our system in this country came from the British system. They had it first, and they gave it to us. And they had a debate in the House of Commons in 1914 about the creation of money. And this is what Mr. Michael Meacher said.
It is unfortunate that it is so little understood by the public that money is created every time by the banks when they make loans. And it is the banks, which determine how much money is allocated across the economy.
And to who? They are deciding who gets the loans, remember that. How does it work? Let's look at it. Okay. When someone, you or a corporation or a township, borrows from a bank, the money put into their checking account is created by the bank, and at that moment, our money supply for our nation grows. Every time a bank gives a loan to a borrower, our money supply gets bigger. When the borrower repays the loan, right? They expect you to do that timely. The money disappears off the books of the bank. So as people are repaying their loans and no more loans are being created, the money supply is going down and down and down. And that's the money supply we need to get our groceries, to buy gas. This is me. What? This can't be. We all need that money. It shouldn't go away. Not only shouldn't it go away, it should be stable. This is not a stable system. Of course, we know that every borrower pays interest. But let's see, our government has borrowed $20.5 trillion. All of us laborers are paying interest on that out of our tax dollars every year. I think the interest is in the order of $400 billion a year, right? What many don't realize is that banks never create the money for the interest. When they create the money for your loan, they create the principal. Like, I want to borrow $100. They create $100 and put it in my account. They don't create the $10 in interest that I have to pay ultimately back to the bank, right? Only the principal of the loan is created in this system. This is designed by the people who created it. They designed it. This is getting very confusing. Why not create the interest if you're going to create the principal? Since the money for interest is never created, money will always be scarce. Where will I get the money to pay the interest? Think about having to pay the bills to the bank, pay back your credit card, and you don't have the money that month. Okay? Get more loans. Don't you look around for another credit card that you can get money from and to pay the other credit card? And that's the reason why the debt levels in our country, at an individual level, at a corporate level, and at a government level, whether it's the national government, our state governments, you hear austerity all the time because they're in debt. They have to pay back the banks. They have to also pay the interest. It's always getting bigger and bigger. That's built into the system because the banks never create the interest, and the fact that they just create our money as debt. Both of those things. All of these are going up astronomically. Well, the bank, and if you don't pay it, the bank gets the wealth. They call it collateral, but it's our wealth. We worked for it. They're not getting anything for doing this. They're not working very hard. Look at the work we have to do to pay our loans back. The system demands that more loans be created, or else the money supply will be inadequate. And what happens? You have defaults. Think about 2008 and what's been going on since 2008. defaults, foreclosures, bankruptcies, unemployment, recessions, and depressions. What was it, 2008, 10 million Americans lost their homes. They couldn't pay their mortgage. Just think of it. The banks created their mortgage. A mortgage is a loan. The banks created that. They didn't take the money from anywhere else. They just created it and demanded repayment with interest, and then the banks lost control of their system in 2008, and we bailed them out, and we suffered. Because we don't know this information. That's the reason. We're letting them get away with this. Truth, a private bank corporation is a unique and abnormal corporation. Think about all the corporations. We want to fight the corporations, but this corporation is the one that has the power to and gives loans to all those other corporations. A private commercial bank has that unique power, and that's why it's so important to know the system. So if the banks give loans, the economy is life, right? We have money if they give loans. But if they decide to stop making loans or call in loans, our economy dies. Now, I've done a lot of reading in history, and I just want to say something about this book. I taught a course on this book, a private course. People Skyped in, came to my house. This is an incredible book, and it's all based on the experience of history. And he started this new monetary reform movement. He's a very brave man in this country. So I just want to say, if you're interested, I have teaching materials to this book. Okay. The banking system decides who gets the money and how much. So we concentrate the wealth to the 1%, because all the interest is going from all our loans, from government, small businesses, corporate loans. That interest is going right to the banking sector, right there. It's going up all the time. It empowers our military-industrial complex, because private commercial banks, they create this money for weapons manufacturers. There's always enough money for them. They always get loans. Universities for military research, private military companies. These are the companies that are getting the loans, not our small businesses. The bank, private banks are making that decision. Empowers financial speculation. You know, where's the real economy? Well, what do we hear about? We hear about the banks creating money for the currency speculation. Stock market, look at the stock market. Why is the stock market so high? Because private commercial banks have given loans to people to go out and buy all this stock. And it's going up and up and up. It empowers that kind of thing. The treasury market, buying and selling treasury bonds, right? Hedge funds. Hedge funds don't use their own money. They have a lot of money, but they don't want to use it, because that would tie it up. Because they have a lot of money, they can go to these private commercial banks, Wall Street banks, and get huge loans. I have a friend, she worked as a secretary in a French bank in New York that's a member of the New York Federal Reserve System. And she said the whole 10 years she worked there, her boss never created a loan less than $1 billion.
Wow.
And he, in his sector, was the media. The media. The derivatives market. That's beyond me. So huge at this point. The system hides itself from the public. This is us, right? Private commercial banks, they create the money for media corporations, like my friend was telling me, that confuse and distract the public, because they're not telling you about the system. If they were concerned about you, they would be telling you, wait a minute, we have to change this, right? History departments
that ignore monetary history. Stephen's book is not taught in our colleges. It's probably not even referenced in our colleges.
I'm teaching a course starting in May that's going on.
There you go. Thank you.
In education.
Economics department. This is what economists do. They say, yes, the money, yes. But, you know, the money is a veil over the economy. Let's not look at it. Let's look at the economy and the supply and demand. They don't look at where the money's coming from, the control that that has. It corrupts our government. Oh, boy. Money in politics, right? Who? The lobbyists get the loans from the banks, right? Super PACs. Hedge funds give to super PACs. Hedge funds go and borrow from the bank, right? Well, that's where the money's coming from. The dark money in elections, too. And I wanted this to keep this in here because I'm in Wisconsin. Right? I mean, that's where I am, right? Okay. And I'm also a member of an organization, Raw Material Economists, a group of farmers. So I've learned a lot about how farming, 70% of our real economy is based on transactions from farming. And that is something that is also kept out of our awareness. The multinational agribusinesses get the loans from the big banks and have driven many, many, too many small farmers out of business. And this is the end for me. In my class, this is what one of my students said. I just loved it. He said, The private bank money system is the root cause and driver of corporate capitalism. He said, it's an essential feature of capitalism, but it's completely missing from the study and definition of capitalism. And I said, you're right. So when people talk about capitalism, I always try to ask them, well, what's money with capitalism? Do you know where it comes from? Remember that. The system can be changed. Definitely changed. It's been changed many times in our history. Okay? And here's how.
Hello.
Oops.
I'm loud. This group has actually worked for a long time with other groups on the history of money to know what can work to make a system that will effectively be better. In Switzerland, they're having to vote is on a referendum for their constitutional change. But this country, only 300 years old, formed with the modern ideal of self-governance. We have it in our constitution already. In Article 1, Section 8, the Congress is given the power to create and regulate the money supply for the nation. Well, Congress gave that away when they set up the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913. But careful study of debt-free currencies in history has yielded three principal points that should be included in a system that could actually work for everybody. They are the same three points basically that are in the Swiss referendum this summer, and they are three points that have been introduced already into the Congress of the United States in 2011 by the great Dennis Kucinich, working together with AMI and Stephen Zarlingo. And it's like three legs of a stool. It's the three legs, they have to be, it is figured out that they need to all be implemented at once. So the first one is that instead of the banks, our government creates all the new money at a rate that maintains its stable value. Stable value is about, if I have a little money now while I'm working and I put it away and then I get to be 90, it's going to have the same purchasing power for me then that it has now. And that's an object of the thing. I won't read the subtitles because we're way late already. The second one, the first one, government creates all the new money. Second, end the privilege of the private banks to create any money. And the third leg is, our government would buy all the shares, because they're privately owned, you know, the Federal Reserve Banks. the federal government would buy all the shares in the 12 Federal Reserve banks and transfer their operations to the U.S. Treasury. This is actually the heart of what AMI proposes and the endpoint or the current endpoint of all the research that's been done. And we aren't devoting enough time to it today, but you've got the slide and you've got places to find out if you happen to have that curiosity now.
So that's a lot that we've put out to you. I just want to take a moment to see if there might be any questions. It won't be a long question and answer period just because we only have 45 minutes, but is anyone, anything? Yes?
So how do we get started as little private citizens here? What should we do?
Hold on to that. That's it. Those are my closing spots.
That's it.
Okay.
We'll take it away.
Yes.
Okay, so my question is about the Federal Reserve. It sounds as if we feel like the Federal Reserve is doing us wrong, but isn't it also dependent on who is in charge of the Federal Reserve and what can we do about at least monitoring who is in charge of the Federal Reserve, since maybe we can't go the distance to completely dismantle the Federal Reserve, what do we do to take charge of who is in charge?
That's a great question. Would one of you like to address that?
My perspective, and I think my colleagues here know, it doesn't matter who's in charge of the Federal Reserve. What matters is that our government should be creating sovereign money, that exists by law and is created by government and issued into circulation, whether that's spent for the public good, federal, state, and local levels, or lent. And that's what Kellogg would argue, but for anybody in this room could borrow it as long as you have collateral. But his crucial thing was at 1.1% interest. But the point is that the government creates the money. And so it doesn't matter who's there. Our government gave away its power to create our money by law, but it's arguably unconstitutional because it's in the Constitution that they are the ones to coin our money and regulate the value of. So I think, you know.
What's the difference between the
co-op? Just because of time.
Yeah. Co-op.
Take your first question.
Sorry.
Co-ops.
My question was on co-ops versus banks.
Yes.
So I just want to give a commercial for Wisconsin that, you know, we're the co-op center of the universe and that they started here.
Right.
And we have the international headquarters.
There still would be co-ops. There still would be credit unions. There still would be banks. There still would be private banks.
Yeah.
We need them. We need people whose job it is to make credit-worthy loans. But in doing so, they don't create the new money. They loan money that's already existing as surplus that I need for my vacation next year, or I need when I retire, or I need for my kids to go to school. I don't need that money itself. What I need is its purchasing power. And for its purchasing power to be protected, that money has to be put to good use in my community so that when I do need it, 5 years, 10 years, 12 years, 20 years, 30 years, that it buys the same amount of goods and services as it would today.
So you put it in the bank and the bank lends that
money? Lends that money out and has to do a good job at it because I'm putting it at risk. If I don't want to do that, I keep it in the bank, but then my money, I keep it in my checking account, you know, and this gets a little complicated. I think we should move on to the first question.
I want to address Beth's great question, and this is what we were trying to lead up to. How many people learned something new today? Oh, everybody's hands are up. it's not an accident that we don't know about this, and Lucille has explained a little bit about the history behind that. I think one of the biggest things is that we learn ourselves, talk about it, and put it on the table, because it is so hidden, even though it's such a critical issue. We have a group that is an offshoot of Stevens Erlanga. This is also called the Gold Brick.
It's as big as you are.
So he started a group called the American Monetary Institute, which acted as a think tank for the last 20 years. And in the last year and a half, we've been trying to take this message out into the general public and really raise awareness with ordinary people and people of influence. There are, the thing that's so hopeful is that we can actually have a system that's different. We can actually have an economy that works for 99%, and something that's actually sustainable. Right now, this current system with the booms and the bust cycles, that last one we had in 2007 and 8, I mean, the cycle's gonna come around, and next time we won't be able to get ourselves out of debt because we're in so much debt already. And so we really do want to bring this to the forefront. And so the Alliance for Just Money, we are in partnership with many other groups, including the Monetary Institute, as well as some other groups, as you can see from this list. One of the handouts that you have is from one of our partners, The New Abolitionism. This is by a pastor. His name is Reverend Delvin Coates, who is a pastor of a black church just outside of D.C. $10,000.
You have a handout.
Yeah, we have a 10,000 congregants in his church. It's huge. And so, not just domestically in the United States, like the Greens for Monetary Reform, U.S. Money U.S., Center for Progressive Economics, Alpheus, Sovereign Money, there's also international groups. Other countries are looking at this and wanting to move this forward. And the thing that's happening in Switzerland that Mary spoke about is very exciting, because it's the first time this referendum has come to the public to decide on whether to have a public money system. So we want to continue the conversation with you. Today's just opening the door, and there's a lot to process. You got to understand, you're on a learning curve, and you don't have to be a huge theorist like these two. I'm still relatively new, so is Mary, but we know enough that there's something really, really key here that it's worth digging. And so we'd like to invite anyone who's interested to continue the conversation over lunch. If you'd like to share with us some of your interests and how we could work together in partnership, that would be awesome. There's a sign-in sheet that's circulating around, again, to continue the conversation and staying in touch, because there is a power that we, especially as women, have. If you think about the women's marches and how people who never marched or never got politically involved, they're like, okay, we're rising up. We don't want this kind of society based on separation and hate. We want something different based on love and cooperation, and we believe that's possible. And so thank you so much for being here. And again, if you're interested, we'd love to have other people join us for lunch to share a little bit more. Thank you.